Good afternoon, you're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, the hard border option is gone, but questions are now being asked about whether Brexit will happen at all. Fine Gael get a big poll bounce from the negotiations with Theresa May. Will it last? And with all the focus on the border, another important decision was taken in the Dáil this week, with some saying it means we've taken the first steps towards signing up for an EU army. We'll discuss all of that and more, but first it's time for the news now with Clodagh Walsh. Clodagh, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. You're very welcome to the programme. Joining us today, we've Helen McEntee, Minister for European Affairs, Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP, Danny McCoy, CEO of IBEC, Niamh Lyons, Political Editor with the Ireland edition of The Times, Noel Whelan, Barrister and Political Commentator. I just want to start by bringing you the front pages of the English newspapers today. The Times: May bounces back, rejuvenated PM to confront Johnson on Brexit. The Mirror: Mrs. Softie, Theresa May's deal with the EU will mean a soft Brexit. More on that in a moment. The Independent Weekend: Britain sets course for soft Brexit. And the FT, Financial Times: May's triumph blunted by Tusk warning on tough choices ahead. Everything isn't agreed until it is agreed finally. And the Daily Telegraph lists all of the concessions that Theresa May has had to make and says it's the price of freedom. And Michael Gove's piece is in there as well, saying everything can be reversed if the British public decide to do so at the next election. And the Daily Mail: rejoice, we're on our way. Historic handshake that sealed a vital step in our exit from the EU. Now, before we get into the detail of what happened over the course of the last week, Danny, I want to come to you because you were in number 10 Downing Street over the last couple of weeks. Will you tell us a bit about that meeting and what the vibe was?
Yeah, so the meeting was called by our colleagues in Business Europe, which is an umbrella group for the IBEX of Europe. So I was there with 10 other European leaders, French, German, Swedes. And we were meeting with Prime Minister May and David Davis and the Business Secretary, Greg Clark. And I was, you know, impressed about going there, but didn't realise how desperate they were going to be. They were good cop and better cop, would be the best way to say it. The Prime Minister was smiling and name-checking everybody. And the hour was really to say, look, business says they want certainty. If you want certainty, we will give you certainty in terms of an implementation stroke transition period. No length of time was put upon it. And they said the reason why they wanted us to go back to our respective prime ministers, in my case, Taoiseach, was to say, look, business needs to know what port they're going to when the transition period starts, which will be March 2019. And if you don't know where you're going to in March 2019, then the uncertainty just continues. So in order to get to that point, you need the time from the December summit meeting to be already moving towards the kind of portfolios around nuclear, food, and security. So they're really keen to be in a place by March 2019 to know where they're off to. And I came out from that meeting, actually, and spoke to RT and said, on the record, I don't believe this is going to be a hard Brexit.
Right, so but all the indications you were getting was that we were headed for the soft Brexit because that was in their interests.
But you've no idea, and Helen will be able to give more expression to this, you've no idea, though, whether they were in control or not. That's what they were saying for that hour. But they did seem desperate. But of course, as we've known, it's been kind of chaos even those 3 weeks since, going back and forth. So I think it's a huge diplomatic success for Ireland. I think the Irish government were right to get that kind of commitment, because it was on the day that I was in Downing Street, Davis was very clear he would not give any written guarantee 3 weeks ago. And so you can see how that's changed. But they are desperate right now. And they're desperate not even about the future. The British economy is in big trouble. They've got anemic growth. They're way less than anybody else in Europe. Like, Germany's at 2.5%. The US, similar. China's going well. So the world is in huge demand. The only thing that's keeping them in growth rate at the moment is their manufacturing industry is having a 30-year high. And the reason that is because there's so much world demand out there, and they give themselves a devaluation. But for households, and this is indicative for Irish households, is their consumer price inflation on food and drink alone is 4.8%. And their wages at best are 2%. So households in Britain are already having their living standards fall. And that's a really significant issue for bringing them around to, I think, for this alignment, I think, is code for the softest Brexit possible and potentially no change ultimately at the end of a long transition period.
Brexit reversal.
I don't think it will be done legally, but I just think it will be, they will stay aligned to the single market and customs union. And the longer the transition period, the better for all concerned. Mm-hmm. Things will change.
What do you think, Helen, when you hear people saying today that, you know, what we see this week could lead us down the road of no Brexit at all? Because if you're going to stay aligned with the single market and the customs union, then why leave?
Well, I think Danny's right. I think the train has left the station, and obviously that process has started, and it doesn't look as though it's going to stop. But certainly, I think the outcome on Friday, the agreement of the text that was reached between Ireland and the UK, I think is much more significant, not just for Ireland, but for the rest of Europe and what kind of a deal we're going to be looking at into the future. The wording around alignment, and obviously we're talking now not just about north-south alignment, but east and west alignment. And this is in the absence of this comprehensive free trade agreement. So what they're talking about is having something that's possibly even closer, because it would enable there to be no border on the island of Ireland. So I think it's positive. I think we are moving in the direction that, while they say they won't be in the single market and the customs union, so much of their industries and their various different sectors will be aligned with the single market and customs union, that in effect it might seem as though they haven't. Now, at the same time, it does leave them at a disadvantage. It means that while they will be technically aligning themselves with the rules and regulations, they're not going to be there around the table to actually say what happens, because obviously we're not just talking about current rules and regulations, we're talking about rules and regulations into the future. And if they're not around the table, they won't have a say in it. So I think it's a pity, and I think perhaps in time that might become more apparent. So I think to watch.
What about Danny's characterisation of them being desperate in number 10?
Well, I have to say, I think Theresa May, as the Taoiseach has said a number of times, has always acted in good faith and has tried to do what is the best for her country, her citizens and her economy. And I think that's why we have the result that we have this week, and that's why we have reached this agreement. You know, she wants to see a close relationship between the UK and the rest of the European Union, because that is what is best for the country. So how that has come about, and I suppose maybe changes that have happened over the past few weeks and months, you know, whether that was her personally changing or whether it was the people around her. But, you know, however that has happened, I think it has been good.
I'm not sure how it's going to work. I was trying to figure it out since it was published. So you have Belfast has to have no divergence from London, but Belfast also has to have the same rules as Dublin. So
London has no divergence.
So London and Dublin have no divergence. So how will that work in practice?
British politics.
Sorry, Noel, come in there. Yeah.
British politics is not capable of handling a reversal of Brexit. So I don't think we're going to have a reversal of Brexit. What we're going to have is Brexit in name only. I think you're gradually going to find a process where a whole range of parts of the economy, markets and otherwise, are going to literally be doing as they're doing now, closely aligned with all the regulations and systems of the European Union, in a sense shadowing or following or tracking changes in European policy and regulation, but having, as Helen says, no direct input into. The British government has taken the frighteners. Their economy is, as Danny says, and he's better placed to assess it, is in short order. Their politics is in a mess. The impact on the union generally, Northern Ireland, Scotland and otherwise, is this. I mean, they were warned in advance and now begin to realise tends towards volatility. And all of that has come together for them to, as itemised on the front of the Daily Telegraph today, to roll back on all of their big red lines. No divorce bill. They're coughing up the money. Mm-hmm. No transition period. It will be at least 2 years and perhaps longer either. No written guarantees. They have now been given. And it's worth, I think it's worth acknowledging, you know, September 1939, when Germany invaded Poland, Ireland had what many historians would look at up to then as a peak moment of sovereignty, a moment of peak sovereignty, when it said, we have the capacity to hold a neutral policy during the Second World War. It was a tactical analysis, a presentation of our sovereignty at that point. I think this week, Friday in particular, was a moment of peak sovereignty for Ireland. A really significant moment, which said we were able to, by sharing our sovereignty with the European Union, leveraging our relationship and support from the European member states, place ourselves in a stronger position to negotiate a deal. And negotiate is too big a word for it, because the British are not in a very strong negotiating position, but to put in place a deal through and with Europe on this first stage of Brexit. And it's also, I think, a significant moment north-south, because it actually was the Dublin government, as you know, for the island of Ireland, because Northern Ireland politics is in limbo, And because the loudest voice in Northern Ireland the last week being the DUP represents a quarter of the electorate and a minority on the even in Northern Ireland on the question of Brexit, that the Dublin government was able to assert itself into that position of sovereignty and power and say, on behalf of the Ireland of Ireland, they've put together one hell of a good deal.
So the fact that the Northern Executive is suspended played well for government?
In circumstances where the Northern Ireland Executive is in suspension, border communities and the communities of Northern Ireland were lucky that the Irish government was prepared in a sense to firstly that it shaped the negotiations in a pattern that had key issues dealt with at phase one, that they were able to play large elements of bilateral with the British, but in this overarch of leveraging the EU's 27
priorities. It might be worth just reading out the Daily Telegraph, what they say the price of freedom is. Divorce bill of up to £39 billion, 3 million EU citizens to be allowed to stay in Britain and bring their families, the European Court of Justice to oversee the rights of EU citizens until 2029, no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, and the UK to remain in the single market and the customs union until at least 2021. I mean, they must be asking themselves, Niamh, what the point is.
I wonder about that divorce bill, because the talk now is that for the next 2 years it's going to be more or less £20 billion a year, because they have to pay in the same amount as they would have if they were members.
And yet Michael Gove saying today we'll have all this money to invest in education and the NHS once we get through this payoff period.
Absolutely. And then after that, the figure being talked about is about a £30 billion figure. So I think the bill could actually end up going higher. I mean, I think the difference in what many of the British angles are on this, including in the London version of my own paper, The Times, is that there's a real focus on the idea that this is a fudge. Nothing is agreed till everything is agreed. I mean, we've been hearing that till we're blue in the face, but sufficient progress is just that. It's not meant to be a conclusion. And I think there has been some real diplomatic expertise, probably starting with Enda Kenny, actually, when the sequencing was decided for this, making sure that Irish issues were front and centre early on. And then as we've seen with the senior officials and Taoiseachs, the likes of Martin Fraser and John Callanan, the people who have basically been ensuring that the language among the 27 has stayed the same. And I find that particularly extraordinary. I mean, haven't we always heard down even through Lisbon treaties or, you know, when anything is getting done at European level, somewhere along the chain, a link breaks, whether it's over in the Eastern Bloc or elsewhere. And that just hasn't happened. Nobody on our side has ever budged, and no element of our position has ever changed. Whereas on the British side, they've had to make compromises all along the way.
Mm-hmm. And the Taoiseach, Lynn Boylan, was criticised after Monday in the press conference, where he said he was shocked and surprised and disappointed when the deal fell apart. And some criticised him for using that language. But actually, it worked.
Yeah, I mean, I think the political deal that we have at the moment is welcome. But I mean, there is an awful lot of detail that has to be worked out. And I agree with you. I just don't see how you can square the circle of what was agreed with a Brexit at all. Because if you have this non-divergence or this alignment of regulations, as you're saying, between the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland and the east-west, the only way that you can do that is having Britain remain in the customs union and the single market. And I don't think that the Brexiteers are going to be happy with that. And the media in Britain is particularly influential. Those very hardline Brexits, they're going to try and ramp up the pressure on Theresa May that this is a complete sellout. And our fear is that she will roll back on some of that, because it is just a political agreement. Nothing is set in stone. And as I say, nothing is agreed until it's agreed. So we would have concerns around how that's going to be implemented in the future. So we welcome what's put down on paper, but there's a lot of detail that's going to have to be worked out.
From our perspective, we got the guarantee on no hard border. That's what we wanted from this part of the process.
But you're already seeing from the British point of view, they're unpicking that and saying it doesn't apply to everything. It only applies to certain points of economic sharing. So we want the Good Friday Agreement protected in all of its parts and no hard borders. So when you're hearing British government already starting to try and unpick it, and that's what we're saying. The British government have not kept their agreements in the past when it came to the north of Ireland. And Theresa May is going to come under increasing pressure over the next couple of months.
Helen?
I think what's really important in what was actually agreed, because as far as we're concerned, this is, to use the theta, a cast iron agreement. This is something that the UK government and the task force have agreed in order to move on to phase two. But there's an actual paragraph in it that says moving into phase two, there will still be an Irish specific channel, because you're right, there's obviously different interpretations of what alignment means and what areas would be aligned. But what's very clear in the text is that there will be alignment in areas that pertain to A, the Good Friday Agreement, B, areas of cooperation north and south, and C, the all-island economy. So there's a huge amount of work to be done to actually identify, and it's not just two or three areas, it's not just aviation, agriculture and maybe one other that seems to be suggested. There are at least 142 areas of cooperation north and south. There are many more that we feel possibly on top of that. And then you look at the all-island economy again, going back to not just now, but into the future. So there is a huge amount of alignment. So they can actually leave the single market and customs union, but have a spectacular amount of their own different sectors and industries aligned. But to ensure that that actually happens, that they don't pick it apart and pick and choose, there will be a specific channel in phase two on the Irish issues, that we have the full support of the 27 member states moving forward. And I think that's really, really important.
It's a terrible mess, isn't it? It's a terrible mess.
Danny? It is a mess. And I think that's the point to come back to, is that I think this has been very good. It's been a relief in the last week that we can see some stopgap, or I mean a default position, if there is a no deal. It still remains the case that a G7 country that we are so tethered to is going through this kind of crisis, and it is not positive for Ireland. And so what we really need to get is a situation now where Britain can be as aligned as possible to the wider EU, because that's in all our interests. And in fact, in the future of Europe, that alignment is going to become much more significant, because one of the things that we've learned around Brexit is how deeply connected we are socially, culturally and business-wise. Both countries are real hubs of globalisation. They're the only ones with increasing populations in Europe of any significance. And so it's a real tragedy for us, Brexit, still. So it's relief this week, but let's not lose sight. We're in still really dangerous territory here.
What about the Ray Bassett argument that if we tether our wagon to Europe, we risk damaging, and some would say we already have damaged, our relationship with Britain, and we need to be very careful?
I think this week demonstrates at the sovereignty point that Noel said, that sovereignty, you know, business is only one element of this. And, you know, being the head of IBEC, it's the business interest I was most looking at. But, you know, it's a wider context. And being part of that EU27 really gave us the power this week to basically, you know, take something that could be incredibly damaging and have a way out of it now. And that also applies to business relationships. But Europe is much stronger with Britain in there, because if they go the route that looks like now a soft Brexit and they're out, not only will they not have taken back control, they'll basically have lost all control. And in fact, you know, let's wise up. Britain is incredibly important in their openness and attitude in the type of model we have, business model as well. The loss of that influence in Europe, I think, still remains hugely significant. We still have to hope that they'll reverse this.
I see a lot of what happened this week as nearly bringing the horse to water. You know, even the language from Donald Tusk about breaking up is hard to do. I think sometimes he tries to be kind of twee about it, but to get across the idea that if you look at the personal relationships involved and compare it to the political relationships, nothing is ever better after this type of thing happens. And the EU are under a bit of pressure to make sure that's the case. I mean, when you look at what's going to collide a little bit down the line, when there's going to be European elections taking place around the same time as, you know, are Britain going to be triumphantly leaving and saying, well, thank God we've seen the back of that, while everyone else is trying to get their seats back for Parliament. And I think the other area as well that struck me as quite unbelievable this week, this idea that there had been no basic tabletop planning done, David Davis had to admit. I actually think that that is so unbelievable. You know, Britain invented the civil service. The idea that Ireland's revenue would have carried out detailed examinations of the consequence of Brexit, and that Her Majesty's revenue haven't done the same.
What about the theory, though, that it was done and it was so awful?
Oh, I would imagine. I'd imagine there's contingency plans for the sterling and all sorts. So what we're seeing now, and we asked the Taoiseach during the press conference the other day, you know, what are our priorities for phase two now? And two of the things that came up were fisheries, most importantly, and aviation was up there too. So when you talk about regulatory alignment, it's going to come to a point where the only way to ensure that the break-off suits Britain will be to keep things as close to the status quo as possible.
But your problem then is that they won't have any representation in the European Parliament, they won't have a seat at the Council, they won't be able to have a say on any of the regulations, and that's not going to keep those Brexiteers mm-hmm. happy, and the likes of your Nigel Farages will come back out of the woodwork and start trying to ramp up the pressure.
They'll be receivers of regulation rather than designers mm-hmm. of it. They just literally have to take it as a given. I think actually probably what happened in Britain was not that they did the impact assessments, found they were wrong, and then are hiding them, because legally now, with the contempt of Parliament issue arising, that would be an impossible position for David. I suspect what's happened was they began to do the impact assessments and decided, let's not go there, because politically this is not
a good idea.
Not palatable, mm-hmm. As it were. But Katie, the other thing is that, like, language in international relations, multinational relations, and particularly in the relationship to European integration, and Lynn will know this from Parliament and the Minister, from Council Ministers, language wins are important. Because when you get into the minutiae of detail of negotiating everything from fisheries to agriculture to business and trade, everybody refers back to it and say, well, hold on, if we can't decide what the parameters are, then you refer back to the original text, which is it as close as possible?
Okay, well, you brought up language. So let's have a listen to Sammy Wilson from the DUP speaking on the News at One yesterday to Keelan Shanley.
In Northern Ireland, their handling of this has been seen as cynical, aggressive, green, partisan, has damaged relationships which were built up over a long period of time. And as a minister in the Northern Ireland Executive, I had very good relationships with the finance ministers in the Republic. But I can tell you, none of them would have dealt with Northern Ireland in the way that those two, Coveney and Varadkar, have dealt with Northern Ireland. And they have, whether they like it or not, they have damaged those relationships, and are going to have to do an awful lot of work to convince unionists that they are not seeking to undermine Northern Ireland's position and using Brexit as a cover to do so.
Helen, what do you think? Those two, he says, Coveney and Varadkar, have damaged relationships with unionists.
Well, look, I mean, it's fair to say that there is certainly a strain on relationships following this, and the same East-West as well. But, I mean, we are in negotiations, and I think the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have been very fair, I think, very clear, very consistent in our wording, and following on from Enda Kenny as well, our position has never changed.
Do you regret not bringing them along on Monday and at the start of the week?
The DUP, well, I mean, it wasn't for us to bring them along. So, I mean, negotiations throughout this entire process were between the UK government and the EU task force. And we are obviously part of that EU task force, the 27 member states.
Do we not have a responsibility to say to Theresa May, have you spoken to the DUP here?
Well, it's not down to us to say to Theresa May, you need to speak to the DUP, no more than she needs to speak to Sinn Féin or other parties that are in the North
as
well.
But in a wider context, given our history and given how he feels yesterday, you know, where this has taken us, should we not have minded them more and put our arms around them a little bit and said, are you with us here?
Well, I mean, there's always engagement with parties in the North, but it's all parties. But throughout this process, and this is why this has been our strength, because we have remained solid with the 27 member states. We haven't engaged in separate meetings on negotiations with any parties in the North or with the UK government. And I think that has had to happen that way. And that is why we have the result that we have now. I think there needs to be a period of time now where we, I suppose, try and build relations again while we try and to go back to what Danny said, I mean, you know, we don't want to have a bad relationship with the UK or with parties in the North. They are our closest friends and allies and have been for a long time around the European table as well. So it's extremely important that whatever happens moving forward, that we are on good terms, we are on solid terms, and that applies to the parties in the North. So I think there's a body of work that needs to be done. But I would, you know, I would say that I don't think the Taoiseach or the Taoiseach have behaved inappropriately. I think they have been consistent and remain consistent in their work.
There'll be an attempt to rebuild, is what you're saying.
Well, I think, of course, there'll be an attempt to try and, if there are difficulties there, that we can try and, I suppose, sort out those difficulties. But again, our focus needs to be now on phase two and ensuring that we have close relationships with the parties in the North, but also with the UK government as well.
Noel, do you want to say something there?
Breaking up is never easy, but they left, you know, they choose to go. And the DUP, let's remember, the DUP were effectively laundered a slush fund through party accounts to pay for the Brexit campaign in London. So the DUP have placed themselves in the position they're in. Brian Feeney made the point in an exchange I had with him during the week that Sammy Wilson is no longer central to the DUP yeah. membership and is often first over the hills in these kind of controversies. He did indeed, as he said himself, had a strong relationship, for example, with Brian Lenehan when he was Minister for Finance in Belfast. I tell you, Brian Lenehan would have negotiated a deal precisely along the same lines as the Fine Gael government has this week. So he's been delusional in that extent. We at the point of breakdown, at the point of divorce, there has to be moments of frank talking. Everybody being mannerly and polite achieves nothing in terms of sorting out the real issues. And while I can appreciate there's a desire to heal relationships, I think things could get worse with the DUP before they get better after the final terms of Brexit are agreed. And maybe we have to just take that frank talk.
We have to try and understand where they're coming from as well. I mean, they were in quite the pickle there. And that was the mistake that Theresa May made earlier on. I mean, I suppose she speaks to everyone in the North thinking they all, you know, have built-in interest in protecting the Good Friday Agreement. We now know the DUP don't even want it referred to as the Good Friday Agreement in the text. They want it referred to as the 1998 Agreement.
And that happened.
And we know that Arlene Foster, I mean, part of the reason she left the UUP and joined the DUP was because of that particular agreement and the fact that she didn't support it from very early on. Also, I mean, as Noel was touching on, I mean, say Sammy Wilson perhaps isn't seen as being in the inner circle. It was difficult for Arlene Foster, as someone who wasn't First Minister, who was just a party leader, but whose party, not that she has a seat as an MP, but her 10 MEPs are over there supporting a government. Now, if Theresa May had even the slimmest majority, or if perhaps they were even in a coalition, they could have grumbled and gone along with it. Unfortunately, this deal was being done on their backs. Mm-hmm. That was an impossible situation for her to put them in. You know, and as Helen said, it's not really our obligation, I suppose, to have been pushing the Taoiseach and Taoiseach together with Arlene Foster. But I suppose this is the reason the likes of the British Irish Councils and all those numerous bodies exist. You know, everyone's supposed to be greasing the wheels on these type of issues when problems arise. And there has been a major eye off the ball in relation to the Assembly all year. We're now a full year without it. And all of those things, including the death of Martin McGuinness, have all played into what happened this week.
OK, Lynn.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, with the Assembly, you wouldn't have gotten any agreement between the DUP and Sinn Féin when it comes to Brexit. I mean, we're on polar opposite sides of it. And, like, I think with Sammy's comments are not reflective of the broader community in the north of Ireland. Even DUP voters are not in favour of Brexit because the farmers, the business people, they know that it's in their interests to be part of the single market and the customs union. So Sammy Wilson is not even representing the people who have voted for him in terms of his language about Brexit.
There were calls, though, over the last couple of weeks for Sinn Féin to suspend the row over the Northern Executive, get it together over this crucial period and have the row later. Did you think there was merit in that argument?
But you are never going to get agreement between the DUP and Sinn Féin on Brexit. It's not possible.
Foster were getting some near some interesting common language a year ago.
I think when Brexit actually happened, I think there was an attempt to come together and I think it was very much focusing on a soft Brexit and what would
but
be good for Northern Ireland.
But that document was prehistoric by the time these talks came around and unfortunately nothing had moved on since then.
No, and I think the focus now needs to be on actually setting up a functioning assembly and getting things moving again and getting negotiations starting again. So, I mean, in that regard, our own government will be there to work with the parties and to try and see that happens. So I think that needs to be a focus now.
Well, I think what we do welcome was the comments yesterday from the Irish government about that the Irish nationalist community in the north will not be left behind again or neglected, which I suppose in one way is an admittance that they have been neglected by governments in the south. But what we need now is strong leadership from the Irish government in reaching out to all of the political parties in the north and to the communities and the business sectors and the farming communities. The border campaign, the border communities against Brexit is a broad community-based project, and that's what we will need now, is to be going in and negotiating with them and getting, I suppose, a consensus about what we want on the island of
Danny
Ireland post-Brexit.
Last word to you on this and then we move on.
Yeah, the big thing we've been talking about the north and Britain. Actually, one of the things for me was the other EU26, not just the support they gave us, but actually in the document now underpinning the common travel area, because that could well have become a negotiable piece at the very end, because it leads to the distinction within. We are now, in that agreement, being identified as even special within the EU27. Yeah. And I think that is, you know, the morning after the referendum, socially and politically, if that escape valve for both parts going back and forth across the Irish Sea as citizens, not just in travelling, I think that is a massive social underpinning for Irish people. You know, the EU in all its compositions will come and go over the centuries in various forms, but that interlocking now, I think, is part of the identity that we are sharing these islands and that we're willing to come back.
Some of the provisions in that document are quite chilling in relation to the other 26. From kind of now on, anyone who, under the withdrawal agreement, who's from one of the other 26 living in the UK, is going to face security checks and going to have to tell authorities whether there's any criminality in their background. I mean, imagine a French person living with their family, you know, in a house in Clapham.
With an old conviction, may have to leave
for something silly, like, you know, in their youth. It's we have skipped through there because of the common travel.
It's not just sharing this island. I think we should look at it. We're now sharing the two islands.
Yeah. Okay. I have to take a break. More after this. In the studio today, we have Minister for European Affairs Helen McEntee, Sinn Féin MEP Lynn Boylan, CEO of IBEC Danny McCoy, Niamh Lyons, political editor with the Ireland edition of The Times, Noel Whelan, barrister and political commentator. And on the line now, we have independent TD for Wexford, Mick Wallace. And Mick, I'll come to you in a moment, but I just want to explain to our listeners that on Thursday, the Dáil voted by 75-42 for Ireland to join the PESCO agreement on greater European cooperation on military missions. Niamh, translate all that for us. What does this mean?
It's kind of seen as a precursor to an EU army. And signing up means that you can sign up to various different elements. We will also have to up our defence spending. And a point that Mick made in the Dáil during the week, he'll probably make now, at a time when our own defence forces are saying they're struggling to get by day to day, the idea that we'd be investing in military equipment, it just seems a bit bizarre. This was kind of a good example of new politics during the week, although those against PESCO didn't manage to win, but they certainly made their voices heard, because this was the type of thing that was going to be rammed through without much debate. But the business committee came together a few times and after a few rows allowed for a little bit more debate time. Unfortunately, there was a huge call from most sides of the Dáil, including even at one point Fianna Fáil. They wanted to have this debated after Christmas. The likes of Brendan Howland actually wanted to have this done at committee level, where you would have scrutiny of the motion itself, what it would do, and even bring in members of the senior members of the Defence Forces to ask them their view on it. The government side never faltered. They said all along, this has to go through. If we want to join up, we have to join up now. I'm not entirely certain whether that's correct. I think normally with these type of operations, you can join at any time further down the line.
Okay, well, Mick, let's talk to you about this now. What's your problem with PESCO?
Well, I suppose, as Lynn was outlining there, the first problem was that there actually hasn't been a proper debate about it in the public realm.
It was in the Lisbon Treaty, wasn't it?
It was flagged in the Lisbon Treaty, but just to give you an example, I was in a coffee shop on Thursday morning and I asked six different people in there what was PESCO. None of them had even heard of it. There hasn't been coverage of it. There hasn't been a public debate about it. Secondly, what do I find wrong with it? Well, I mean, the clear aim of PESCO is to develop the EU's military capabilities and to make them available for EU military operations. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily be confined to peacekeeping, and they would allow the EU to intervene in conflicts those in Libya and Syria.
So you see this as us signing up to be part of an EU army. Is that the bottom line?
Well, I mean, the Europeans are admitting that this is aimed towards developing a European army. Ireland seems to be the only ones in denial about this. This is a path towards a European army. The Europeans are unapologetic about the fact this is exactly what the plan is. And I don't believe, I mean, only last year, Independence for Change commissioned a Red Sea poll on whether the Americans should be allowed to continue to use Shannon as a US military base. and 57% of the people, despite the fact that it doesn't get mad public coverage, 57% of the people said they didn't want Shannon used as a US military base.
Okay,
I don't think that the Irish people want to be part of something like PESCO. It's a military alliance, and we've seen that the militarization of Europe in the last number of years, Europe last year spent $200 billion on arms. We're second only to the Americans. We're already, and there's the amount of problems that are coming out of this militarization of the world is hugely problematic and has created over 60 million refugees. It's nonsense.
So, and you also said in the Dáil that we are signing up to be part of a military regime with warmongers.
Well, I mean, France and Britain have, I mean, what they did in Libya in 2011 was shocking. And unfortunately, the Fine Gael Labour government at the time had no problem with it. I mean, Libya was destroyed by the likes of Britain and France intervening, along with America.
Okay.
I mean, it was just madness. There's no logic to it, like. I mean, it's completely irrational.
Stay there for a minute. I want to get Helen McEntee's reaction to that. Have we signed up to be part of an EU army or not?
No, we haven't. I mean, what we currently have at the moment is areas of crisis management and peacekeeping operations coming in under common security and defence policy. What this is doing is actually strengthening that. I mean, we have threats to international peace and security, not just within Europe, but around our neighbouring communities as well. And what we need to do is make sure that we can cooperate, that we can work together, and that we can strengthen areas that we are already working on. This is, for Ireland, very much an opt-in, opt-out, as Niamh said. There are various different missions that will take place under this. So, for instance, Ireland is looking at maybe taking place in a maritime surveillance mission, or where you have cybersecurity information being shared on certain platforms.
And so who will take those ad hoc decisions as we go through?
Well, we as a government will decide what we are doing. And I mean, what we've been very clear in going through PESCO, and I don't think it's fair to say that this has appeared out of nowhere. As you say, this is coming in under the Treaty of the European Union, which came under the Treaty of Lisbon, which the people of Ireland voted for. But it has been very much on the agenda of the European Council, but also the European Foreign Affairs Council, where the conclusions have been debated in the Dáil, in the committees. It's been raised as topical issues and commencement matters in the Dáil and the Seanad. But we will decide, and we were very clear in Ireland, actually specifically asked for wording to be put in to say that a country's constitutional elements or constitutional provisions cannot be impacted by this.
And so there are our other neutrality country, will not be
interfered. Our neutrality cannot be interfered with.
If there's another Srebrenica, for example, would we be part of an effort to counter something like that? Will we be stepping in to defend another nation?
Well, what we're talking about is an opt-in, opt-out clause.
And the government will be making that decision. So the people of Ireland wouldn't have a vote in a referendum, for example, to decide on something as momentous as that.
But if it impacts on our constitution, and obviously we are a constitutionally neutral country, so that would obviously have to go to a referendum. I mean, there are four other countries that are similar to us. I think it's Finland, Sweden, Austria and Cyprus have also signed up already, and they are in a very, constitutionally, they're in a similar position to us. So, I mean, we're not signing ourselves up to an army. The idea that we have to increase our spending, I mean, there was a suggestion that we had to increase our security and defence spending by 2% of GDP. That's not the case. What they're talking about is your overall budget, 2% going towards development, and that it would go into a centralised pot. But all that does is actually allow our own security and defence to access the most up-to-date and the most modern training mechanisms, which allows them to be better at the peacekeeping missions that we hope that we can continue to be part of.
Mick, does that not allay your fears?
Absolutely not. If Ireland likes the idea of being able to opt in or opt out of something, like, for example, what they've done in the Mediterranean. I mean, that's a choice they'll always have. You're joining up something here. We're not joining up as time members. We're either joining it or we're not. And I mean, one of the arguments they gave the government that were given in the government briefing paper this week was, it says, were Ireland to remain outside PESCO, we would lose the capacity to shape policy into the future. Why in God's name would we want to be shaping defence policy in Europe? That to me is nonsense. And it also says it would likely be taken, if we didn't sign up, it would likely be taken by some member states and the institutions as a signal of reticence about the EU with the potential to affect our influence in other areas. Listen, the people of Europe know that Ireland wants to be part of the European Union. That's why we're in it. And the people are bored to be in it. Right? So that's not an issue. How can you say that if we don't sign up to a military alliance, that we don't have to do anything with Europe. And listen, to go back to Helen's point about it's enshrined in our neutrality, that enshrined in our constitution, that we're military neutral. But I mean, I made the point in the Dáil this week. If there was an alternative government formed in a few years down the road, and they decided to let the Russians use Shannon as a military base, would people think that we're still neutral? They wouldn't, and they'd be right. We're not neutral at the moment. If we're allowing the Americans to use Shannon as a stopover to carry out military missions, which they do, and the notion that there's no arms going through Shannon is just ridiculous. We are not neutral. We've taken sides. And in fairness to Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, I know by their language that they'd actually rather be able to say, hold their hands up and say, listen, truth is, no, you can't afford to be neutral in the world today. We're with one side or the other, and we're with the Americans. That's actually what they really believe, and that's what they'd like to say. But you know what? They know that the Irish people don't want us not to be neutral.
Okay.
Irish people want to be neutral, but right now we're not.
Okay. With all due respect, I mean, to say that we don't want to and we shouldn't be part of decisions that are made into the future that impact on our own security, we're talking about threats changing, and they have changed. We're talking about terrorism, we're talking about cybersecurity. But most importantly, I mean, by Ireland signing up, it will allow us to engage further in peacekeeping, in conflict resolution, strengthening international security. That's not sending people off to war. That's okay. Not joining up to a European army.
Noel Whelan, you want to come in there?
Everything the government has done this week has been enabled by the Irish people in a succession of votes on European treaties. Mick opposed the latter two of those because he was opposed to the level of cooperation that things like PESCO involved. But the people voted overwhelmingly in the second instance in Lisbon in favour of enabling a decision of the Cabinet and on occasions the Dáil to sign us up for this. It's precisely this type of cooperation. I mean, words like precursor to a European army or a step to, I mean, the first of 100 steps to a European army isn't a big issue one way or the other. The problem is this is entirely constitutionally enabled by the people of Ireland in referendums which Mick and others lost. There is nothing in the text of these agreements or in fact any rational interpretation of the text of these agreements that points to the kind of scaremongering that Mick is involved in. The European army of itself is a good thing because the alternative to European army is complete NATO dominance. And given the political volatility and the foreign relations volatility displayed by the Americans in this week and in the last year in particular, Europe would be better to have an army of itself. Whether we participate in that army ultimately is a question that would require a constitutional referendum in this country. So there can be a European army with or without us. That's the reality.
But we'd need to have a referendum
if we
on
were
our
to
involvement.
Participate in any
in
a NATO,
NATO yeah.
European, a downsized European feature that was, say, consistent with NATO that wasn't as American-controlled as NATO inevitably in. Our soldiers, and in some ways it is a pity that the defence experts in the country and the chiefs of staff and others weren't brought in to have this conversation, because our military will tell you, you know, as I said during the week, they're not here just for cute moments on the toy show. They're not here for draining water when we have floods or for bringing bales to farmers whose farms are flooded. Their principal function is to participate in international peace and cooperation and support and in a sense, advancing Ireland's political objectives internationally. They can do that with greater skill.
But that's not what PESCO is. I mean, I'm over in Brussels and I see all the time the debates about the further integration and the militarisation of the European Union. Jean-Claude Juncker has said himself that he would like to see between 2021 and 2025 a permanent European army type structure. I don't believe that the Irish people want any part of that.
But so we will be asked.
But in all those discussions,
this is the first step. And PESCO is the first step in a European army.
15, 20 years ago, I didn't interrupt you.
2 hours of debate was just not enough for such a huge monumental decision to be taken by the Irish government to sign Ireland up to PESCO, which is the first step in that European army. And I think at the very minimum, what should have been done was put into the Oireachtas Defence Committee and have the debate, have the experts come in, have the legal opinions come in around the constitutionality or an unconstitutionality of this decision. To railroad it through in the manner that it was done this week when everybody was distracted with Brexit is shameful. And I don't think it's what the Irish people
want.
Well,
maybe we should be having that conversation. If an atrocity happens in Europe, are we going to continue to say, that's terrible, will somebody do something about that while we sit on our hands?
One of the key reasons why the Lisbon Treaty failed the first time around in Ireland was around concerns of neutrality. And we were given all these promises that we wouldn't be involved in the militarisation of the European Union. We were promised that, and the people voted, took those for their words, and voted the second time in Lisbon. And now here we are, coming to fruition of what we had said was going to happen with the Lisbon Treaty.
And you lost that vote, a majority and voted the other way
because we were so defudged by the Fianna Fáil government at the time to get people to vote for Lisbon a second time round.
But the people
80% of people are in favour of Ireland's neutrality. In the last poll that was asked on it,
15, 20 years ago, everybody said Partnership for Peace, which has been a terrific success in terms of both political asserting that type of sovereignty I talked about by sharing it with others. 20 years ago, people said that was the first step and that was going to be the precursor 15 or 20 years ago to a European army, and it didn't turn out to be anything like that. 15, 20 years ago, the former Yugoslavia was imploding and Europe was entirely powerless to do anything about it, and we were waiting on the likes of Bill Clinton
and others. This decision, for the first time now, allows oversight of Ireland's budget and its expenditure on armaments, effectively. And it's not, and as Niamh was saying, we have soldiers who are having to get income supports. They can't survive. They're sleeping in their cars. And here we are in a situation where we're going to increase spending, but it's not going to be increasing spending in ambulances and helicopters or in pay scales for the defence forces. What it is, it's an increase in expenditure on armaments.
OK, well, look, has the ships...
And I don't think the Irish people want that.
Can I just clarify on that? What we're talking about is spending 2% of our defence expenditure on research and technology. So again, research and technology is across the board. It allows our own security and our defence forces, as Nola's rightly said, they don't just sit around and do nothing. They're there to actually partake in various different missions. This does not impact on our neutrality unless the Irish people want to change that. And this is a wider discussion that has to take place.
Because the Danes haven't signed up for a lot of European integration.
Because the Danes respect their position and they got a proper protocol, unlike the Irish government.
Mick Wallace, Solidarity People Before Profit TD, Richard Boyd Barrett, said he's considering a constitutional challenge. Do you think the ship has sailed, or would you join him on that?
We're checking out the legal merits of it, so I can't say that yet. But it was interesting when Noel was making his points about Lisbon and Nice, it was interesting that he forgot to remind the people that we actually voted against them first, and because we voted wrong, we eventually had to vote again. It's a wonder the Brits haven't been asked to vote on Brexit the second time.
Well, the difference,
I didn't interrupt you, Noel.
But you're stating it in Akron, Michael.
A million people voted more for
the second Lisbon Treaty.
First of all, Helen's making the point about all the money that's going to go into the research and development, right? Research and development is actually... It's a very worthwhile exercise a lot of the time. But most of the money going into research and development in defence in Britain or in Europe at the moment is geared towards improving armaments and planes and whatever. And they're improving elements that are designed for war. They're improving elements that are designed to bomb people's homes.
And peacekeeping.
In the last 16 years since Afghanistan, right, the thing has got completely out of control. The Americans spend over $600 billion now on arms production.
All right,
it's the biggest industry in America today.
Okay.
And if they stop dropping bombs on people's homes, it's actually going to affect the share prices of the companies that run them.
Mick, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on the line. That's Mick Wallace. We'll take this break. We're going to talk all about the Lewis and the Cross City launching it just after we go on air at 2 o'clock, but we don't have time. So I want to do a bit of what if-ery with Noel maybe and Niamh. The poll during the week that showed Fine Gael at 36%. If we had had that election, would those numbers have come to pass?
Well, in advance of any such election, we'd all have been predicting a similar return. But it goes to show that election campaigns are entirely unpredictable. And the Brexit negotiation process was likely to have had a dynamic upon the election. I think that what's happened is that people were holding their judgment on Leo Varadkar ultimately, and then they got to see him at his worst and his best the past 3 weeks, and ultimately he comes out on the positive. Opinion polls are a moment in time. It was taken at a very good moment for him. But I think I've been arguing for 6 months that Leo Varadkar has the capacity to be transformative on Fine Gael's vote. He still has that potential. And I think what will be interesting to see is how Fianna Fáil struggle with trying to counter that fact and the fact that they are straddling both government and opposition. People keep saying it, he's denigrated the British press, for example, for being a young Taoiseach. I think in part of the, it's because he's a young Taoiseach that he's getting some of that traction.
Last word, Niamh?
Well, I think sometimes we hear anecdotally about the public don't want an election. And to be honest, the public basically have a polite indifference towards politicians, what they do and whether there's an election, you know, if it comes to their door. But by all accounts, the week that we nearly ran into an election, they got absolutely hammered on the doorsteps. And I'm not sure that the figures would have been there for the Taoiseach that week. But by the following week, standing up to Britain, it was massive. And I suppose, as Noel said, it is a point in time. It's an important figure. I personally don't really believe that Fianna Fáil is as low as 25%. I think that's its basic core figure of support. And I'd imagine it's much stronger. And if we had an election in the morning, it would be. But I think Sinn Féin even was underestimated in that poll as well. So I think it's still all to play for.
It certainly is. And we've another week to come. Thank you all very much indeed for being with us today. That's all we have time for. And we're back here next Saturday at 1 o'clock. And of course, on the television, RT1 on Monday night at 10:30. Hope you can join me then. Bye for now.
Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Anne Farrell. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. Research was by Leslie Anderson, and Tom Norton was on sound.